Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
We are going to begin a new Mishnah today. And I'm going to remind you that sometime back when we were learning this Masechet, we discussed various kinds of substances that could be best used to form a wick for the Shabbos candles. Really, originally Shabbos lamps. Candles are a fairly recent invention. We are 24b2. Sounds about right. Yeah, the Mishnah. Daf Chav Dalet Amud Beis. And because we talked about the various substances that could be used to kindle the Shabbat lamps, so the Mishnah invariably ended up discussing other lamps. What's the most natural lamp to discuss? The Hanukkah lamps. The Hanukkah menorah, which is made of Hanukkah lamps or Hanukkah lights. And once we discussed Hanukkah lamps, we got into a discussion of Hanukkah in general, and that is where the Talmud discusses our Jewish festival of lights. There is no special Masechet called Hanukkah. There is not even a chapter in the Talmud, and that's a subject for a different day. Having completed now the sugya of Hanukkah, the Mishnah now returns to the original subject. And we're going to speak about the appropriate fuel that should be used for the kindling of our Shabbat candles or Shabbat lamps. So previously in the Mishnah, we learned about a number of different fuels that should not be used. And we had a discussion about two reasons why a fuel would not be appropriate for a Shabbat lamp. Number one, because it would sputter and it wouldn't burn in a clean fashion. And this would cause a person to violate the Shabbat because he would be adjusting the wick, and that's not a good thing. Or we discussed the idea of it not being respectful for Shabbos. The whole reason we have Shabbos candles, we should have peace, serenity, not concern and anxiety. So the Mishnah gave us a discussion of what may or may not be used for the kindling of the Shabbos lamps. For most of us today, this is superfluous. It's commentary. We just go to the store and buy a box of candles. Understood. But there were times we didn't have a box of candles in the store. And there were times under extenuating circumstances. And times when we might really ask this question, what can or cannot be used. And this Mishnah discusses the background. Okay, with no further ado, let us approach the Mishnah, which is going to introduce us to a particular kind of fuel that actually is not a kind of fuel. It's something that happened to any kind of fuel, as we're going to see. And the fuel we're going to talk about, the first thing, the discussion opens with something called shemen sreifa. Shemen is Hebrew and it means oil. In modern Hebrew, getting an oil change is also called shemen. But really, originally, shemen meant oil that could be derived from foodstuffs. And the most famous of all is the olives, shemen zayit. Israel was famous for that. There's a certain kind of oil that has to be burnt. Why? Because we're not supposed to benefit from it. So because we shouldn't benefit, it should be burnt. Once it's burnt, nobody will benefit. What kind of shemen is that? This is shemen, oil that came from special food called truma. And it became defiled, ritually impure. And as such, the Torah prohibits its consumption. And in order to ensure that nobody would accidentally consume it, and in doing so absorb what would be spiritually toxic, the Torah tells us that the shemen should be burnt. And that's called shemen sreifa. So just for everybody's edification, I give you a quick refresher course on Truma. The land of Israel is a sacred place. And because it's sacred, the soil is sacred, even what grows in Israel is sacred and holy. What is the meaning of holiness? For some people, holiness means that which is psychedelic or mind-altering, that which has wings, or that which will put us into a different kind of consciousness. That is not the Torah's definition of holiness. It may be nice to use a substance. Somebody might feel good, but it's not very holy. Holy, from a Torah perspective, means close to Hashem. The world was created in a manner that God decided to conceal himself. So we shouldn't be able to see him. And godliness concealed allows for a world to exist. Much like a screen, losing the old days before we have the technology that you could have a screen that's all lit up even though the lights are on. In the old days, the only way you could see what was projected onto the screen is if you shut the lights. The darker the theater, the clearer the picture. When God's light is revealed, we all get eclipsed. And we cannot feel independent. We cannot feel as if we have the ability to choose neither good nor bad. We simply aren't. We're overwhelmed by the presence of God. So God conceals his light, euphemistically and metaphorically speaking. And he creates a world. And the word world in Hebrew is olam. And that's a permutation of the Hebrew word helam, concealment. In order for there to be a world, there has to be concealment. Which of course leads many to ask a lot of questions of faith, questions of crisis. How could God allow X, Y, and Z to happen? And they don't have any good answers. In fact, nobody really has any good answers. We don't understand the ways of God. The ways of God are a mystery. That is the symptom of God's presence not being revealed in our world. When Mashiach will come, the lights will be on. Everybody will see. Everything will become clear. Imagine, if you will, a room which is dark. And you have to find your way out. So you spend hours, maybe days, trying to navigate your direction by tapping, touching, trying to figure out, but you're blind, you can't see anything. And then the lights go on. And in one moment, what could have taken you days, months, or even years to figure out, to map out, in one moment, it's all clear. That's what things are going to be like when Mashiach comes. Up until then, the best we can do is have little candles, little lamps, little flames, which is called Ner Mitzvah V'Torah Or. Every mitzvah is like a lamp. It's like a flame. And when we perform a mitzvah, sometimes we get a sense of clarity, a sense of surety. We feel a sense of closeness to Hashem. Sometimes you don't feel it. Just matter of fact, it happens to be so. The meaning of holiness from a Torah perspective is that which is godly. So when a Jew performs a mitzvah, that's the way the world is supposed to be. When any human being, in fact, is doing the mitzvahs that Hashem gives them, that's the way the world was destined to be. So this is the way God wanted it. So then that's a world with less concealment. The more there are things that are happening in the world that's not according to the will of God, the more we emphasize the concept of concealment. So what does it mean when we say Eretz Yisrael is a holy land? It means it's a land in which mitzvahs, in which Torah, in which the proper behavior should be easy. Of course, the Yetzer Hara doesn't sleep in Israel. He's very busy there too. Precisely because mitzvahs are so much more meaningful, the Yetzer Hara spends that much more time trying to convince everybody not to do the mitzvahs and to behave inappropriately. Going back to the land of Israel and holiness, so that which grows in Israel is sacred or holy. So what does that mean? It means that the opportunity for a mitzvah presents itself. And the opportunity for a mitzvah means that there's a certain holiness invested in everything that grows in the ground. And in order for us to be able to consume it, we have to designate the holiness onto a specific portion of that which grows in the ground. That's given to the Kohen. The Kohen is a person who has a uniquely constructed soul. He or she is able to elevate things in a way that other Jewish people cannot. And then once they do their job of elevation, the rest of us can take care of the leftovers, if you will. Not really leftovers. The whole truma is only 2%. 100 bushels, 98 bushels go home with you. It's just 2 bushels that are given to the Kohen to become sacred. Then there's a tithe that's given to the Levite. Then there's a tithe that's given to the poor, or tithes that are taken to Yerushalayim. Here is the caveat. This food that is separated and given to the Kohen becomes holy. It's called truma. The word truma means lifted, elevated, separated from the rest of the food. In order to eat that food, you've got to have a special soul. You've got to be a Kohen. And not just a Kohen. You have to be in a state of ritual purity. Which is why Kohanim used to go to the mikveh very often. In fact, the entire Talmud begins with a discussion of when night falls. Say, oh, you want to know when night falls? When the Kohanim are scurrying back from the mikveh for dinner. That's when night fell. Why? Because you had to go to the mikveh and then experience Harav Shemesh, to go during the day, and then experience the clearing or the purifying of the heavens from light pollution, so you can see into outer space. And at that time, the Kohen is allowed to consume the Truma. To us, that sounds odd, strange. We've never seen something like this. But once upon a time, this was a common staple of Jewish life. So the Kohen has to be pure. Then we find out something else. Not only the Kohen has to be pure, but the Truma that's going to be eaten by the Kohen also has to be pure. So what happens if it gets defiled? Now it's toxic. ordinary truma is toxic for non-Kohanim. For Kohanim, it's a wonderful thing. If it becomes ritually impure, it's toxic for everybody. And it's a grave sin. It's like eating chametz on Pesach, like eating on Yom Kippur. It's something that has a chi of kares. So it's a big one. So therefore, the Torah says something like this has to be destroyed. You can't leave things which are dangerous around. It's like, would you leave knives where children are going to be coming to play? How could you do that? Somebody's going to get hurt. There's nothing that can be done. Nothing can be performed with this truma. It has to be burnt. That's the only way we can, so to speak, rid it from this world so nobody gets hurt. That's called shemen truma. Shemen seifa, pardon me. Oil, which has to be burnt. It's designated for the purpose of being burnt. So now, the question comes, can I light my Shabbat candles with this oil? Person's a Kohen. And because they're a Kohen, they have a supply of oil which became ritually impure. Maybe it was in the room and somebody passed away. Maybe somebody who had a certain kinds of fluid that come from his body was in a state of ritual impurity. Maybe touched that oil and defiled it. This is actually something we should be familiar with because the whole story of Hanukkah is based on the idea of oil, which was supposed to be used in the Beis HaMikdash, was defiled by the Assyrian Greeks who invaded the Beis HaMikdash. But this is not designated for temple purposes. This is designated for ordinary purposes. So the Mishnah says, Ein madlikin b'shemen sreifa b'yom tov. We do not kindle shemen sreifa on Yom Tov. Rashi says, what is the meaning of shemen sreifa? Shemen shel teruma tmeya. The oil that comes from truma, the sacred food that was defiled. U'begemara mefarash taima. Rashi adds three important words. The Gemara explains what is going on here. So here's the problem. A lot of times the Mishnah uses the simplest syntax to convey something which is actually very nuanced. And oftentimes in a Mishnah, we're going to be missing background. Just like, for example, the Mishnah didn't explain to you what Shemen Seifa is. Mishnah pre-assumes you know what Shemen Seifa is. If you're opening a Mishnah, you should know what Shemen Seifa is. And sometimes the Mishnah doesn't include a lot of other details which are required for a better understanding or even a proper understanding of its halacha, of the case that's being demonstrated and the ruling that's being delivered. So we actually have a dispute in the Gemara about a page earlier. We have a dispute between two of the greatest sages, a dispute between Rav Chista and a dispute between Rabba, what the meaning of this Mishnah might be. So it says you're not allowed to kindle Shabbat candles with Shemen Seifa. But then again, why not? It's the best way to kindle Shabbat candles. You have this oil. It has to be burnt anyway. When you're finished kindling the Shabbat flames, the Shabbat lamps, nobody's going to be dipping their bread into those lamps. It's perfect. And you're actually doing a mitzvah with it. Instead of simply wasting the oil, you're actually doing a mitzvah. And the Cohen's family is benefiting. They have a lit up Friday night table. Why wouldn't we do that? So, and then the Mishnah adds the words b'yom tov. But we're not talking about Yom Tov. It's true that on Yom Tov we light these flames also. But we're referring specifically to Shabbat. So Rav Chista's opinion is that the background required for understanding this Mishnah is when Erev Shabbat falls on a Yom Tov, which we actually should be familiar with because we had it three times in a row just this past month. Right? We had what they call outside of Israel, the three-day Yom Tovs. In Israel, they had one. We got three. Yom Tov falls on Thursday. Yom Tov falls on Friday. And then Yom Tov comes. Of course, we have followed by Shabbat, which makes things complicated. One of the things we're supposed to do, we need Erev Tavshil in order to cook, a subject for another night. One of the things we're supposed to do is kindle the Yom Tov and the Shabbat candles. So, Yom Tov came in on Wednesday night. When did everybody light their Yom Tov candles? Whenever. There's no, like, you can light it a little earlier. You can also light it a little later. Nothing wrong with lighting it later either.
Before Yom Tov comes in.
It doesn't have to be before Yom Tov comes in. Because on Yom Tov, you're allowed to kindle fire.
By transfer.
As long as you have a transfer. So in theory, a person could light the candles, a woman could light the candles an hour after Yom Tov began. As long as you have a yahrzeit candle, you have fire on the table. So, but most people usually light the Yom Tov candles before Yom Tov begins, the first night. Now, the second night is a problem. The problem is that the first day of Yom Tov is of a biblical origin, And the second day for us is of rabbinic origin. And because the rabbinic Yom Tov has a lesser holiness than the biblical Yom Tov, it would not be appropriate for us to be welcoming a second day of Yom Tov, which is but rabbinic in nature, before the biblical Yom Tov comes to a conclusion. And therefore, we wouldn't daven Maira, for example, we wouldn't pray the evening service until night had fallen and the first day of Yom Tov is completed with certainty. We also wouldn't light the Shabbat candle, the Yom Tov candles, before the first day of Yom Tov has already concluded, because by lighting the candles, what do we usher in? We usher in the day of Yom Tov. You say, Asher Kedushanu, b'mitzvotav v'tzvenu, lahadlik ner shel Yom Tov, you're ushering in the second day. You can't usher in the second day. You didn't finish the first day yet. The first day is biblical min ha-Torah. The second day is only rabbinic.
Question. Other way around. Yom Tov comes first, the first day.
Yeah.
Shabbos comes.
Oh, I was about to say. You took the words out of my mouth. Now comes the word 24 hours later. You're going to say, well, you can't light Shabbat candles. Would you want to truncate the second day of Yom Tov and usher in the Shabbat? The answer is, first of all, most definitely, Shabbat is biblical and the second day of Yom Tov is rabbinic. But it gets much more complicated. Once the sun goes down on Friday, which is the second day of Yom Tov, you're not allowed to light candles anymore. So now we have a real problem. When would we light the Shabbat candles? When do we light the Shabbat candles, in fact? We ahead, exactly, 18 minutes before the sun goes down. We make sure to light the Shabbat candles when it's still Yom Tov. And it's still Yom Tov, which means, of course, you needed to have a Yahrzeit candle or some way that you had fire available, because you wouldn't be able to strike the match and create a fresh fire. So Reb Chisda says, this is the background of this Mishnah. Ein madlikin, says Reb Chisda, you do not light the Shabbat candles, b'shem and sreifa b'yom tov. You shouldn't do it when it's Yom Tov. Why shouldn't you do it when it's Yom Tov? The answer is that the mitzvah of destroying, appropriately destroying, that which is supposed to be used for a sacred purpose, and for whatever reason can't be used for that sacred purpose, so it has to be destroyed, which this is known as Sreifat Kodshim, the mitzvah of destroying that which is naturally holy should not be performed on Yom Tov. Allow me to explain. What happens if we didn't finish eating all the meat at the Pesach Seder? Of course, we don't have meat at the Pesach Seder. We shouldn't have meat at the Pesach Seder because people might mistaken that with the Paschal Lamb. That wouldn't be good. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the main feature at the Pesach Seder was not the little boy and girl saying Manashtana. It was not even the matzah. What was the big feature, the main feature? The Korban Pesach. And the halacha is that the Korban Pesach must be consumed in its entirety on the night of Pesach. And it even has to be eaten b'chipazon, in haste. It's the pressure, as they say, is on. You got to get this done. What happens if you leave the Korban over till the next morning? What happens then? You're not allowed to eat it. So what do you have to do with it? You have to burn it. When did you burn it? The next morning? No, you have to wait till Yom Tov ends. You have to wait till only the morning after would you be burning it, which the Gemara is going to actually talk about, this example. Another example, and this is a little more relevant in our day and age. Chametz is destroyed, disposed of, or emptied from our jurisdiction prior to the arrival of Pesach. Yes? What would happen if chametz was discovered on Pesach?
Huh?
Making a statement is a very good thing. Because in that statement you say that all chametz which comes my way is ownerless. But I can only make things ownerless before it came my way. What happens out of my jurisdiction? What happens if the chametz shows up on Pesach? How could chametz show up on Pesach? Here's a very simple example. A person took flour and water. And in the old days they used to make matzah themselves. Take the flour and water, roll it up very quickly and bake the matzah right away. Something happened. There was a tumult. The people ran outside. The Matikin came back in, and now we have chametz. What do you do with it now? So chametz on Pesach, what do you have to do with it? You got to destroy it. Can you destroy that chametz on Pesach? Why not?
Because the destruction is actually work if you're burning it.
Work? But you have a fire going. You're cooking. Take that chametz and throw it into the fire. The answer is you're allowed to burn things for the purpose of cooking, eating. You're not allowed to burn things.
Well, you're not allowed to benefit from it. And if you use it for the fire, for a meal, you're benefiting.
So don't use it in that fire. Make a different fire. My point is you can kindle fire in Yom Tov. In fact, smokers can even smoke on Yom Tov.
Yeah, by transfer.
We're talking about transfer. Why? Because that's like food for them. They smoke all the time. That's a basic need. So the point is, you're allowed to use fire if it benefits you in some way. However, you're not allowed to use fire if it's not for the purpose of your benefit. Burning kachim, burning that which is designated, was designated for a holy purpose, but now has to be burnt. So something like that is not permitted on Yom Tov.
One more time.
Can you burn the chametz on Yom Tov? No. What do you have to do with it? You have to set it aside, make sure nobody eats it, and you burn it after Yom Tov. Imagine, I once had guests over on Yom Tov, and they brought a gift. What was the gift they brought? They brought a big set of Play-Doh for my children on Yom Tov. Play-Doh is mamash chametz. Play-Doh is made to be edible because kids eat Play-Doh. And I don't want to embarrass these people. I'm like tearing my hair out. So, first of all, it was the last day of Pesach. We kicked it into a corner. And whatever, after Pesach, I had to burn it. It's chametz brought to my house on Pesach. I don't want to own it. First of all, I don't want to know. They owned it on Pesach. The whole thing was problematic. Right? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? My kid's like, you sure we can't use it, huh? I'm like, yeah, I'm 100% sure you can't use it. And actually, the only thing I did gain from that, or my children gained, was a good lesson in halacha. They'll never forget the rest of their lives. So, point being, you can use the fire to light Shabbat candles, Yom Tov candles. You can light up a cigar if you're a smoker. You can do all kinds of things, as long as you're benefiting from the fire. But to perform an act of burning that which is designated for burning, which we call Shemen Sreifa, you're not allowed to do that on Yom Tov. You understand? Does it make sense? So that's the pshat, says Reb Chisda. Reb Chisda says, the meaning of this Mishnah is, Ein madlikin b'shemen sreifa. You cannot light Shabbat candles with shemen sreifa, with that which is designated for the purpose of being burnt, as we discussed. It has to be disposed of through burning, through incineration. You cannot do that b'yom tov, meaning when Friday is Erev Shabbat is on Yom Tov. Rabba disagrees. Rabba is of the opinion that a person would never be allowed to use this kind of shemen for the purpose of Shabbat candles. Why not? Well, it goes something like this. We learned in the previous Mishnah that you cannot use the kind of fuel that would require adjustment. You know, anybody ever go camping? You know, somehow the arsonists manage to make fires that can burn entire buildings down like this, and you can't get a campfire going. You know what I mean? Like, you just wonder, like, why it's so hard, especially if you got kids and the kids says, are we ready yet? Can we cook the hot dogs? When is the marshmallows? And you just can't get this fire going. And then you have this little kerosene lamp or something, and it keeps extinguishing, and you keep playing with the fire, and you keep trying to make it. You know what I'm talking about, right? So this is a problem. This is a why? Because on Shabbos, if you do that, you're going to be violating Shabbat. You're not allowed to use, you can't increase combustion. In fact, you're not allowed to read by the candlelight on Shabbos. Why? Because you would adjust the lamp. And if you adjusted the lamp, in today's day and age, this is the equivalent of just adjusting. You have a dimmer, making it a little brighter. But to take a wick and adjust it, this is the same reason we have to, when we leave something on our stove, over Shabbos, we cover the fire. Why? Because if you don't cover the fire, a person sees a large fire, what's their natural instinct? Without thinking twice. You lower the fire. So it's the same idea with reading. My Zayd, alav shalom, used to tell me how when they were in Siberia, sent off for the sin of Yiddishkeit, and ultimately my great-grandfather was murdered in cold blood while my grandfather, his son, was in prison. So they were living in this, I don't know, it's like unbelievable conditions. Lived in some corner of some non-existent building. And my grandfather had smuggled a Gemara, Meseches Ksubas, which is called Shas Katan. It's the tractate that has something of everything in it. A tiny little Masechet Ketubot, he had smuggled it in his underwear. Because that was illegal, that was a big crime in Russia. He had smuggled it to be with his father. And in the end, because he ran to Siberia to help his father, that's why he didn't get killed by the Nazis. Otherwise the Nazis came to Kiev and he would have ended up in Babi Yar. But anyway, he had this little tiny Gemara. And for the better part of a year, this is I think 1935 or 36, that's all they did is study Gemara together. There was nothing to eat. There was nothing to keep them warm. I don't know how they kept body and soul together. But what they did is they studied Torah all day. It would come Friday night. And my great-grandfather was very, very assiduous, a very big masmid, very dedicated, didn't like to waste a moment. He wanted to learn Torah. But the only thing, they had a tiny little lantern. It's a tiny Gemara. So my Zayde used to tell me that his father would study Torah without trying to look to him. He would hold his hands behind his back. He would hold his hands very tightly behind his back. And he would keep reminding my grandfather that they should make sure that they don't move their hands. And he would peer in the Gemara and try to make out the words of the Gemara. This is an example of what we're talking about. So if it's fuel that doesn't burn easily, we shouldn't use it for Shabbat candles. Why? Because what might you naturally do? Adjust the flame. Rabbi said, you know, Jewish people, we're a funny nation. Innately, we love to do mitzvahs. We just look for mitzvahs. And what happens is, when a yid finds out that this shemen is actually supposed to be burnt, so one of two things happen. Either the Yetzer Hara comes along and a Jew doesn't want to do the mitzvah at all, and he starts rebelling and making his immature, juvenile statement of independence, I don't have to do this just because the Yiddishkeit said. But once a yid gets over that hump, once you get over the first Yetzer Hara, and you get into the mitzvah, what happens?
He wants to do it as soon as possible.
We get into it. We get into the mitzvah. We want to do it with both hands. So now, Rabbi says, my concern is, since he knows the oil has got to get burnt, and the person looking at the candle, he says, no, it's a slow candle. Why is it burning so slow tonight? It's a mitzvah. We got to have this all done. He wants to go to bed, and the candle's still burning. So without thinking, what might he do? He's going to adjust the flame. Give it a slight movement, and all of a sudden, there's more wick, so it catches fire, and it gets bigger. And in the meantime, you violated Shabbos. In your quest, in your desire to do a mitzvah, sometimes you end up doing the opposite. Understand? So this is the issue over here. And according to Rabbe, then this is something which is universal. It doesn't matter which day Erev Shabbat falls. Of course, according to Rabbe, the question is, what is the meaning of the words B'yomtif? And the answer, according to Rabbe, is, Rabbe says, even though on Yomtif it's permitted to burn things, so here you'd be lighting a candle, it should be permitted on Yomtif. Rabbe says, yeah. But you're not allowed to burn things for the sake of burning things. And since a person might adjust the flame so it will burn more quickly, once again, he'd be violating Yom Tov as well. This is the background required to understand the first five words of the Mishnah. You see? This is the Mishnah. Five words takes a half hour of background until you know what the five words are talking about. This is why we have a Gemara. Because once upon a time, people have this, it was so clear to everybody, the moment you repeated a few words of the Mishnah, everyone knew exactly what you're talking about. And then there came a time when this wasn't clear to us anymore. And because it wasn't clear to us anymore, now we have to have a whole background. Mashal l'ma'a davar daima, here's a silly metaphor. You go to people who are very, very fluent in a game called hockey. And you're listening on the radio, or they're watching on television, or maybe watching today on their iPhone, and you hear the announcer scream, he passes, he shoots, he scores! And you know exactly what he's talking about. And a person who never watched hockey in his life says, passes, he shoots, he scores, and everybody's cheering. Could you explain to him what just happened over there? He says, you don't know, passes, shoots, and scores. I don't know what that means. What do you mean passes? He passed out? He passed away? No! He said he was shot! He shoots! Who did he shoot? He scored what? You made holes on him? You know, you score something. Who they cut? It's a strange people. Somebody dies, somebody else is shot, and somebody else is getting scored.
That's a problem with the English language.
No, that's not a problem with the English language. It's a problem when we're not familiar with the syntax. Once upon a time, the Mishnah, Yiddishkeit, was so clear to people, the lights were on, they knew exactly what you're talking about. The Mishnah comes along, of course, he shoots, he scores. That's exactly what that means. A few hundred years go by, nobody's played hockey for now 300 years. I don't know what he's talking about. Now you need a university degree. a PhD, and even then they have no clue what they're talking about, to try to explain the theory of what this could have meant. He shoots, he scores. What does this mean? And they have 16 theories of what it possibly could have meant, and people writing books about it, and nobody really knows with that or any kind of certainty. So when the Gemara comes along and starts to analyze the Mishnah, the Gemara has to reacquaint us with something we're not familiar with anymore. And then you know what happened? Another few hundred years passed that. And then you know what happened after that? We didn't understand the Gemara anymore. So then we had the Rishonim came and explained the Gemara. I'm letting you know what the Gemara said a page ago. Because otherwise you would never be able to appreciate this Mishnah. Right? So when the scholar sits down to read the Gemara, he breaks his head to figure out what's going on. But I don't want to have a broken head, so I'm explaining to you what's going on. So you got it? Rabbi Shmuel Eimer. Now the Mishnah goes on. Rabbi Shmuel introduces a different teaching. Ein madlikin be'itron. You're not allowed to kindle the Shabbat candles with itron. Itron is a fuel. And the fuel that actually burns quite well. And that's why it wasn't mentioned with the previous fuels that sputter. The fuels that do not move their way up the wick fluidly, but instead somehow get stuck. And they don't burn well. Itron burns quite well. So why shouldn't I light with itron? Okay, what is itron? Itron, you figured it out?
Yeah, pine oil.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to tell everybody what Rashi says. And I want to note that your English translation doesn't know what to say. But you guys figured it out. You may be right. I'm not saying that.
Perfect sense.
Okay, it makes sense, but it's not what the words Rashi says. Rashi says itron is pisulta de zifta.
That's exactly what pine oil is.
What are you talking about?
Zephet
is what?
Tar.
Zephet is tar and pitch.
Yeah, which is pine oil.
Pine oil is pitch?
When you injure a pine tree,
yeah.
Out comes that sticky thing.
That's pitch?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure. Okay, anyway, I think that pitch is tar. I think it's tar.
It is also.
Oh, it is tar also. Okay, so here's the thing. Zephet, traditionally, the first time Zephet shows up in the Torah is last week's Torah portion of Parshas Noach. And we read that Noach had to coat the teva, the gigantic floating barge, right? It was a survival device that was going to have to not only brave waters that would be violent and a rain that would be torrential, but also with sulfuric acid in the water. Okay? This took Noach a long time, 120 years to build this barge. One of the things he had to do was waterproof. And how did he waterproof the wood?
With Zephet.
And the pitch was on the outside, a thick coating of pitch on the outside, and a thick coating of pitch on the inside. Now, here's a little piece of Jewish trivia. When is the next time a floating device shows up that has Zephet on it?
Moshe.
Exactly, Moshe Rabbeinu. There, the Zephet was only put on the outside, not on the inside.
In both cases, it didn't come from petroleum because they didn't have petroleum yet. So it had to come from...
It's a vegetarian.
Reb Ami says that it's a vegetarian thing. I agree with you. That the Gemara seems to indicate it's vegetarian. And Ami and Zev here decided that it's pine oil. Maybe you're right. I don't know. So what's the reason that for Noach we had pitch on the outside and pitch on the inside? And for Moshe Rabbeinu, there was only pitch or tar on the outside and not on the inside. So there's two reasons that are given. The reason number one, Moshe Rabbeinu was going for a nice, peaceful little float down the Nile River. Where he was going to end up, nobody knew. Miriam was 100% sure a miracle was going to happen. A miracle did happen. You know what the miracle was? See, Miriam camouflaged this little floating cradle very well. She camouflaged it so well that only she could see it from the shore. Nobody could see it. And she hidden behind the bulrushes. And there was camouflaged this little floating thing in the bulrushes. And Miriam was going to wait to see what happens. At least the Gestapo wasn't going to be looking for him anymore because they were following some astrological ideas. And therefore, they were going to, all the babies that they could throw in the river. And now the baby's in the river already. What Miriam didn't know is that if you came from the side of the water, it was plainly obvious. Who shows up? Yeah, Hitler's daughter shows up. That's what the Pharaoh was, a Hitler. The Pharaoh used to bathe himself in the blood of Jewish babies. He would have 100 Jewish babies or so decapitated, their blood squeezed out of their writhing bodies, and then he would get into the hot blood and take a bath. He made Hitler look like half normal. A monster. his daughter, Batya or Bitya, she decided one day, she was so disgusted by her father's idolatry, she decided that she was going to go for a mikveh. She was going to immerse herself in the river. And so Bitya didn't go in that. Everybody was. Where Jews could come along the Nile Delta. But she went away from the palace. She wanted to go far away from the palace. I'm sure she had this private swimming area, which was a palace which was right on the river. She went far away. And Hashem directs her footsteps. Where does she come? Boom, she comes. Sees a little floating cradle. And she wants to go. And the servants who are with her, like, oh, we don't do that. That's a big Jewish kid. And they get struck down. Read Rashi carefully. The angels strike him down. And then they try to prevent Basya, and a miracle happens. Basya's hand stretches very, very long, and she reels in this little floating device. And what does she see? It's a baby. She sees a beautiful little baby. She says she must be a Hebrew. And the rest, as I say, is history. Point being, Miriam had no idea how long that cradle was going to sit in the water for. And it had to be well-proofed. For all Miriam knew, she was going to be coming out every couple of hours, bringing some food to the baby, and then going back to her hiding place. Bringing some food to the baby, go back to her hiding place. And then Batya comes and snatches the baby. So really, to be sure that this thing could float, maybe it has to float for weeks, maybe for months. We don't know what's going to happen with this baby. It would have been wise to put pitch on the inside also. Say, well, there wasn't torrential rains, there wasn't sulfuric acid. It was the Nile River, a beautiful river. Nonetheless, you still could have taken a precaution. So there, Rashi tells us, quoting our sages, that Hashem didn't want that the tzaddik should have to breathe in the fumes. They shouldn't have to smell the fumes. And I would add my own little take on that, which I have no idea if it's correct or not, but maybe the fumes, when a baby smells fumes, it could actually harm the baby. Certain harsh fumes could actually kill brain cells. And Moshe Rabbeinu needs every brain cell he got, right? He's got a very big job. So it wasn't just about discomfort. Maybe it was more than discomfort. Maybe he wouldn't have to smell those fumes. But Noach wasn't such a tzaddik. And anyway, he wasn't going to kill too many brain cells. He was already 600 years old. And he wasn't developing, wasn't an infant. So it stank. The whole thing stank. you had to survive. This was not a pleasure boat. So here's the point. What do we learn from this? What do we know from this? I don't know what tar is. I don't know if it's pine oil.
Well, I remember
answer me a simple question. Does pine oil stink or not?
And how?
Oh, maybe you're right then. Maybe it is pine oil.
And how?
Okay.
We used to burn it in the school in order to empty the school.
I see. Okay.
How did Pharaoh's daughter Batya become a Hebrew name when she wasn't Jewish?
You're asking a question about Batya's name. Why don't you ask about Moshe's name? It has four opinions in the Rishonim about it. One opinion in the Rishonim is that Moshe is the Hebraic interpretation of the name Musa, which was actually given in Egyptian. Other Rishonim say that Basya already was learning Hebrew. And eventually, there's an opinion she converted and became part of the Jewish people. And she figured it's a Jewish boy, she should name him a Jewish name. But this is beyond the purview. It was just like a piece of trivia thrown in because we're talking about Itron. What's Itron? Rashi says Itron is not pitch. Itron is the fuel that's derived from the pitch. Okay, in the words of Rashi, it is pesolta. Pesolta, pesolus, in Hebrew means the leftovers. So pesolta is the leftovers. That means once all of the quality material has been taken, the leftover material, or what you would call in English, the garbage, the toxic stuff, the dregs. So this is the psolat of the itron. Now it turns out that pitch is actually not flammable in a typical sense. Pitch actually is a you have to heat it up, right? But if pitch is the liquid form of pitch, or the liquid residuals, the oily residuals of the pitch, are flammable, and they burn quite well. So why can't you use it on Shabbat? Says the Mishnah, b'pnei kvoida Shabbos, because of the honor of Shabbos. Rashi says, the honor of Shabbos is to have lights on. You shouldn't be in the dark. Yeah, Rashi says, Sherechai Ra, that it smells terrible. Does it ever smell? Okay, I guess we figured it out. Really? Okay, maybe it is pine oil. So if it's pine oil or something like that and it really smells, I mean, the lights are still on. So the Mefarshim explained in Rashi Yeah, the lights are on, but nobody's going to sit at a table that smells that way. So therefore, everybody runs away from the table that smells horrible. And where do they go? In some dark corner. So the whole purpose of having the Shabbat candles was which should be illuminated. And it should be pleasant. And instead, we have a lousy, foul smell. And instead, we have people who are distinctly uncomfortable. And it's unpleasant. So that's why you shouldn't use it. So previously, the question was, what fuels could be used or not? Why should you not use a fuel? Because the fuel is not amenable to Shabbos in that it needs to be adjusted. Here we have a new kind of fuel, and that's why it's in a different Mishnah. Here the problem is not the way the fuel would burn. The fuel burns beautifully. The problem is a secondary one, zugezunt. The problem is not that the fuel doesn't burn. The problem is that there is a side effect of terrible fumes. The Mishnah goes on, Rabbi Shmuel goes on now, and the Mishnah goes on, v'chachamim matirin. The Chachamim permitted it though. And we're soon going to see why the Chachamim would have permitted something which, on the surface, Rabbi Shmuel's words seem to make a lot of sense. But we'll get to that.
Anybody could have dinner after they smell that stuff.
Okay. we're gonna hear about that later. So the Gemara, the Mishnah goes on. Remember, this Mishnah, I only spent a lot of time explaining the first few words of the Mishnah because we couldn't understand the Mishnah at all without the background. And there was two ways of explaining it. But usually we go through the Gemara. The Gemara will slowly explain the Mishnah. They permit all of the different kinds of oil. Shemen shumshemen, shemen egoizim, oil that comes from sesame seeds, oil that comes from nuts, nut oil. B'shemen tzenoinois, what are the oil that comes from a radish oil or like some kind of scallion. Shemen dogim,
fish oil.
Ah, the Chum permitted all these oils. B'shemen pikuois, with the shemen which comes from some kind of gourd, some kind of a pumpkin. Be'itron ubeneft. Neft is like gas. So the Chachamim permitted all of these things. So we're going to get to the Gemara. The Gemara is going to explain very briefly. Rashi says, Shemen shum shemen chulu, maskona de milsa de Chachamim. You'll see in the end, we're going to come with a resolution like the Chachamim. Tznoin is a radish. Shemen is shemen dogim mikivri dogim shenemaychu. This comes from the innards of a fish that eventually kind of dissolve or liquefy. Pekuos, the last midbari, some kind of desert gourd. Neft, min shemen shereichira, a kind of fuel that has a terrible fume attached to it. Kedar mesechet seder yuma, like it says in mesechet yuma, ba limdoid neft, a person comes and he's going to be measuring this fuel. Aymrim loy, they tell him, medoid la'atzmacha, please do me a favor, you do this on your own. Ein adam reitzel l'saya, nobody wants to help you. Maybe it's like gasoline. Gasoline stinks. You ever have a gas spill? People come in the car after? It's terrible. So these are all kinds of foul-smelling fume. Ethanol? Is that what it is? Okay, there you go, ethanol. Fumes and that they come along. And therefore, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Yishmael said, we shouldn't use it. Nekaveh Shabbos. Racham said, you should. And the Gemara will explain this in great detail. Rabbi Tarfon says, moot discussion. All of these fuels are no good. There's only one fuel that should be used for Shabbat candles. And that is Shemen Zayis. Only olive oil. Now, the Gemara doesn't really explain this. The Mishnah gives us no inkling as to why we should only use Shemen Zayis. There are lots of oils that can be used. What reason might there be for emphasis only on Shemen Zayis? Incidentally, Rashi doesn't explain it either. Well, we have a Medrash, which is found, Medrash Tanchuma, found the Parshas Bahalotcha, which is the Parsha that begins with the mitzvah of kindling, firing up the menorah. And over there, the Medrash Tanchuma says that the reason Rabbi Tarfon has this opinion in Masechet Shabbat is because Rabbi Tarfon says it's clear that the Torah favored one particular fuel, because it's a mitzvah to kindle a menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Beis HaMikdash menorah, had to be lit with olive oil. And since we see the Torah favors it, so therefore, Nerot Shabbat should be with the Torah's choice of fuel. And since it's the Torah's choice of fuel, that's what we should use.
How do we get to Shemen Parafim, or oil of paraffin, which is wax?
Okay, so I'd want you to know that the halacha is not like Rabbi Tarfon, And in some communities, there was an emphasis on dafka lighting shemen zayit. And in many, many communities, they did not follow the opinion of Reb Tarfon. It is an opinion. It is not the maskana. I know the Rebbetzin, the not light with oil. Rebbetzin lit with candles. And here's an interesting story about the Rebbetzin's Shabbos candles. The Rebbetzin used to like to have fresh Shabbos candles for the honor of Shabbos. In the Gemara and Halacha, it says that the candles should be singed before, so it will light easily. Now, today's candles burn easily anyway. But in those days, the candles, you know, it was like handmade. You know, dip the wick in the fat, in the, what's called the tallow. So until you have these candles made. And sometimes the wicks were imperfect, so if you light the wick and then extinguish it, it lights easy. So the Rebbe was a perfect halacha, Shulchan Aruch. The Rebbe did everything exactly like it's supposed to. So the Rebbe said, came used to kindle the lamps. Why? Because it says in Shulchan Aruch you should do that. But the Rebbetzin used to change the candles after, because she liked fresh candles. So the Rebbe did his thing, and the Rebbetzin did her thing. The Rebbe said, hey, you do the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says the husband should do it, the custom husband should do it. So the Rebbe did the custom husband should do it. And the Rebbe said, thank you. And she would put fresh candles in. And this is how it was every single week in the Rebbe's house. At least that's what I heard. So we don't follow necessarily this opinion of using only Shemen Zayit. But there is such an opinion. And incidentally, when it comes to our Hanukkah lamps, Mahadr and Mina Mahadr, and the best way to light Hanukkah candles is Dafke Shemen Zayas. Now, there's an obvious reason. Because the menorah, the Hanukkah menorah, is in the image of the Beis HaMikdash menorah. So, I mean, that's why we have latkes that are fried in oil. It's all about, the whole emphasis is on oil. So it makes perfect sense. It's not. But we know also that Shemen Zayas is the purest light, the cleanest light. And the Tosfos seems to feel that the reason that the Tarfon would say we should only use the concept of Shemen Zayas is because the least possibility of having to make an adjustment is when you have Shemen Zayas. It's a very clean, natural, easy burn. And the flame is very, very clean. Okay, this, my friends, is the Mishnah. Now, after finishing the Mishnah, which is somewhat wide-ranging, the Gemara is going to analyze the specific statement that we began with. Ein madlikim b'shemen sreifa. We do not light shemen sreifa b'yom tov. Let's say we follow the opinion of Rav Chista, that the point is, if Erev Shabbat is yom tov, that's when the Kohen would not be able to use even shemen zayit. In fact, probably shemen zayit, because the olives are a truma. But the shemen sreifa, if it's yom tov, you can't use it. Why can't you use it? What do you mean I can't use it? Simple reason, because you're not allowed to burn kodshim. You're not allowed to burn something that has to be incinerated on Yom Tov. The Gemara says, really? Really? And why not? Like, why not? It's a mitzvah. Why can't you do it? You can fry yourself eggs, you can cook a soup, but you can't do a mitzvah? That doesn't make any sense. Why can't you do a mitzvah? Well, this is just theory. We can't have just theory. These are all theories. The Mishnah requires ironclad, because every theory could have a counter theory. We need to have proof, some kind of biblical proof. We need a clear ruling, a source in the actual Torah that tells us we can't do this on Yom Tov. And that's what the Gemara begins with. The Gemara says, my taima. My taima. What's the reason? Why can't you do it on Yom Tov? That's the question. My taima. Why not? And the Gemara answers, you know why? I'll tell you why, my timer. Lefi, because she'ein serfim kodshim, we do not burn something which is a mitzvah to incinerate, which I explained to you is something that was supposed to be used for a holy and a sacred purpose. It wasn't used for its holy and a sacred purpose. Now what should be done with it? Now it should be destroyed. Now it should be incinerated. We don't do that on Yom Tov. Gemara says, okay, that's very nice. Could you please explain why? Why not? Or, where do you get that from? Says who? And that's the next point of the Gemara. The Gemara says, Minohani Mili. Minohani Mili is a Aramaic slang. Minohani Mili means, from whence do these words come? Or from whence does this thing come? So Minohani Mili, it's spelled like in slang fashion. From where do we get these words from, these ideas from? And so the Gemara is going to give us a number of different sources that we traditionally used to teach us that we should not destroy that which is a mitzvah to be destroyed on Yom Tov. Says the Gemara, Omar Chizkiah, the famous sage Chizkiah taught. V'chein tana devei Chizkiah, and the same teaching also emanated from the Beit HaMedrash of Chizkiah. So maybe it could be means they learned it from Chizkiah, or maybe they came to the same conclusion because they studied Torah with this, under the same tutelage. And they said like this. Amar Kra, the verse says with regard to the Korban Pesach, and I started to mention this earlier. The verse says regarding the Korban Pesach, V'lo totiru mimenu ad boker. Do not leave it over until the morning. What does that mean? That means the Korban must be consumed that night. We have to consume the Korban that night. Don't leave it over. And then the Torah says, this is found, by the way, in Exodus 12, Verse 10. And if it is left over till morning, the verse finishes, surely it will be burnt. You will incinerate it. So the Gemara says, one second. The words of the Torah, which we know the Torah is so sparing on every single word and nuance. The Torah's words were, "V'lososiru mimenu ad boker." Don't leave it over till the morning. "V'hanoser mimenu ad boker." So the Gemara says, She'ein Talmud Lomar, we didn't need you to tell me the second Ad Boker. It says, don't leave it over until the morning. And if you will leave it over until the morning, if I was writing that sentence, here's how I would write it. Don't leave it over until the morning. And if you do, or if you do leave it over, then you will surely incinerate it. Right? Because you said already, don't leave it over until the morning. So, and if you do leave it over when? You said don't leave it over until the morning. But the Torah says, don't leave it over until the morning. And if you do leave it over until the morning, then you have to burn it. What is that second till the morning teaching us? It's obvious. It seems totally superfluous. So the Gemara says, Shalehutzrach, we did not need the second Ad Boker. The second Ad Boker was unnecessary. Umah Talmud Lomar, what then is being taught to us? What message is being conveyed to us? Ad Boker, why do we say a second time until the morning? So the Gemara says, Boha Kosov, the scripture comes in this specific instance and case to tell you, Litein lo Boker Sheini Lisrefaso, to tell you that the burning should take place on a different morning. A different morning. On a subsequent morning. In other words, that you would not be able to burn it the next morning. So like, for example, when I came to Argentina, they told me, this is a strange country. Whenever you need something done, they're going to tell you, mañana. I said, what's mañana? They said, tomorrow. And then somebody else told me, mañana means morning. So they said, yeah, mañana a la mañana means tomorrow morning. And the funny thing, the same thing, a few months later I come to Russia, and I'm in this taxi, whatever you want to call it. I smell gasoline. I can't believe I landed in this country. It's like unbelievable. All my senses are being assaulted. And we're driving to from the airport in St. Petersburg. And the guy in broken English tells me, welcome to Russia. Thank you very much. It's like freezing cold. The window doesn't close all the way. There's no heat. He says, whenever you need something here, expect, they'll say, zavtra. I'm like, what's zavtra? They go, tomorrow morning. I'm thinking, I could swear I heard this a few months ago in Argentina. So this is like saying, mañana a la mañana. Ad boker doesn't mean ad boker means tomorrow morning. Ad boker means, v'anotar mimenu, ad boker. And if it'll be left over until morning, not this morning. This morning you already talked about. So which morning is it? Ah. So the scripture is clearly telling us that on Yom Tov, because in Eretz Yisrael we don't have a second day Yom Tov, on Yom Tov it can't be burned. So that's what we know. That's what we know. Now we have a source for this idea. Question was, Minohani Mili, how do I know you cannot burn that which has to be incinerated on Yom Tov? What's the answer? From the Korban Pesach, as the Torah says very clearly. An extra Ad Boker, and the extra Ad Boker teaches me it cannot be done until the morning. So let's say if we're learning the Mishnah according to Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda says, when Erev Yom Tov is Erev Shabbat is on Yom Tov, you wouldn't be able to use this special oil to light the Shabbat candles. Why? Because on Yom Tov you're not allowed to burn it. Why? Because it says Ad Boker. And with this, my dear friends, we will conclude for tonight. Be'ezrat Hashem. In our next class, we're going to analyze an additional four sources for the notion that you cannot use kodshim that have to be burnt. You can't do that on a Yom Tov. And along with the technical proofs, Be'ezrat Hashem, in our next class, we're going to talk about the theory and the theology and the jurisprudence behind this halacha.